Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Rockets Caucus. I am Mark Levine on the line with...
Garland Nixon.
Hello, Mr. Nixon. How are you, sir?
I've never been better, Mark.
That's really good.
It tells you just how miserable my life has been.
I guess so. And someone who is has been better, of course, is Terry DeKester, our co-host, who is out sick today. We wish him well and a speedy recovery. I think he'll be just fine. Maybe he just had a hangover or something, or had a rough night with the police. Who knows?
Yeah, that's what I'm guessing. Or maybe he's still on the run. You know, maybe the cops are behind him even now, and he's involved in a high speed chase.
He's probably on the lam. That wouldn't surprise me.
That's what I'm thinking.
All right, so we got two topics today. My topic is going to be the stock market has reached incredible heights, and the real question is who's getting all that wealth, and the real answer is not the vast majority of the American people. I'll talk about that in the first half hour. And then, Garland, you got the second half hour talking about what?
I'm going to be talking about Eric Holder's statement about the legal authority of the president to kill Americans on American soil. And I'm going to surprise a lot of people on the left, as I have recently, by saying, of course he does. How ridiculous is it to say the president doesn't have that authority? But every president has ever had that authority, and every president will. So we're going to have to talk about.
Yeah, and specifically about Americans on American soil, about whether or not, when this can happen. And he pretty much said only in a very extreme case, and we'll talk about that. So also, let's give out the phone number and encourage people to call in. We are Terry List today, so we may need your help at 202-889-9797. 202-889-9797. We're also videotaping today.
Holy moly.
So if you go to weactradio.com, you can see my sleepy mug right here, and a nice picture of Garland Nixon. We got to get you on Skype, Garland, so we can see you.
Yeah, we sure do. What is it? www.weactradio?
Weactradio. weactradio.com. And I didn't have time to put it on my website, marklevinetalk.com. The reason, of course, is because I, like most Americans today, have forgotten it was daylight savings time. I got up at what I thought was 10 o'clock, realized it was 11, quickly ran in and made into the studio. So just to let you know, I'm on the ball here, Garland. I'm just...
No, for a change.
and other people who are not on the ball, okay, that's a terrible segue, but is the American people. The stock market, if you've been watching the financial channel, CNBC, they're breaking out the champagne and dancing naked in the streets. Okay, I made up the last part. But the Dow Jones Industrial Average has hit record highs. The S&P 500 has hit record highs. And, corporations are just flooded in cash, trillions and trillions of dollars in cash. They don't know what to do with it all. They've given out bonuses to all the CEOs, all the people on the board. And, you know, after you've got hundreds of millions of dollars and then you still got money to burn, you got to go back and you got to write more checks for more hundreds of millions of dollars. And why do I in Anacostia not see golden chandeliers hanging down from every business, Garland? I mean, we're rich, aren't we?
I'm looking at an article right here on Huffington Post, and it says in 2010, the first full year since the end of the Great Recession, the top 1% of earners took in 93% of the income gains that year, leaving 7% of the gains to the other 99%.
How did they get rid of those 7%? I mean, you'd think they would have scooped that up as well.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. The truly shocking part of that is that they left the full 7% for the rest of us.
You know, one of the things that I found interesting when they had this whole discussion on tax reform, and they were talking about the capital gains taxes, which, of course, are lower than ordinary income taxes. The janitor pays a higher tax rate. If he got enough to actually earn that much, then the CEO whose floor he's cleaning. But one of the things I found so fascinating is that half of all capital gains taxes, three quarters of all capital gains went to the top 1%, and half went to the top 10th of 1%, which is all those, you know, that one in a thousand Americans that makes more than $1.5 million a year. So Garland, stop, you know, raking it in so much and let the rest of us share the money. $1.5 million a year, that's a tenth of 1%, and they get half of all these special tax breaks that accrue, you know, that give you better tax rates than those that are janitors, teachers, police officers, and ordinary folk. And I just found that amazing. So, you know, yes, 3/4 went to the top 1%, half went to the top 10th of 1%. So I understand why they're breaking out the champagne on Wall Street. I just wonder if maybe on one of their drunken binges, if some of that champagne comes out, maybe that's what they mean by trickling down to the rest of us.
Yeah, and you know, I've said, you've heard me say a million times, a nation of sheep begets a government of wolves. You know, with all of this income inequality, with, you know, us standing there with our mouths hanging open and our eyes wide, you know, in shock and horror and amazement that these things are going on, we had a recent presidential campaign.
And we did?
One of the guys who was worth a couple hundred million made the point, you know, part of his platform was he wanted to lower taxes even further for the rich. With all the income inequality, one of the guys said, Mitt Romney, I am filthy rich. And the way we need to move forward is to eliminate capital gains taxes. Is we need to just make the rich much, much richer and everyone will be better off. Now, here's the problem I have. Almost half of the voters voted for this guy. Which means, you know, you can't, you know, it's kind of like a con man takes advantage of a person's own greed when he cons them out of something. You know, he says, oh, yeah, you can make $100 million if you do that. And out of their greed, he swindles them out of their money. Well, I think that's what's going on here. You know, it's kind of a reflection of how greedy and ignorant Americans are that we, in huge numbers, we'll look at this income inequality and say, oh, that's all fine. What we need to do is go along with this guy that says we want to give more money to the rich. But then yet afterwards complain. So while it's not you and I on the left, there's a significant number of people in this country who are, and I'm not going to say stupid because they're not stupid. They kind of know what they're doing, but who are okay with going along with the process. But they still don't like the results.
Well, let's talk about where some of this is coming from. By the way, in the campaign, I think it was Newt Gingrich that wanted to end all capital gains tax cuts.
They all do. They still want to do. Ryan's budget, didn't he have to get rid of capital gains taxes?
Ryan may have had it. Romney actually was going to leave a few of them in for the super rich, but it's still not that much. But here's, I think, what it all comes from. It comes from a guy, you may remember a guy whose name was not Joe, who was not a plumber, that they called Joe the Plumber.
Right.
He was actually Sam the, I forget what his real
schmuck,
line of work was.
Sam the schmuck.
What
like
his
that.
Real line of work was. But he came up to Obama very famously in the first presidential campaign and said, do you believe in redistribution of wealth? To which Obama said, well, you know, it actually helps all of us to spread it around a little bit. And he was shocked at this horrific idea. And I got to tell you, when I think of the 47%, ironically, given that percentage, who actually did vote for Mitt Romney, and when we consider the fact that no more than 1% are you know the ones that are raking in 93% of the wealth or half the capital, 3/4 of the capital gains, so forth. When we think of the other 46%, I think some of them have some of this Joe the Plumber ideology in them. It's that, you know. I work hard for my earnings, and I don't want other people taking it away, not realizing, of course, that their earnings are already being taken away by other people. I'm not talking, again, about the 1%. I'm talking about a plumber, right, who does work hard.
Yeah.
And does – but see, what people don't seem to understand is we're trying to increase the wages of plumbers. We're trying to help small businessmen and tradesmen achieve more. And basically tell Wall Street, hey, those trillions of dollars of profits you made from, you know, Chinese kids working under horrific conditions in Foxconn factories, you know, we want to spread the wealth, and that frankly the CEO who earned the money by mistreating those workers didn't do that much work anyway.
Yeah, but and then what you have is this: you have people who are taking advantage of the various social maladies, shall we say, of the right. I mean, you've got people who what they do is they look at people and they look at what they have in common and they say, let's just ignore the results and let's talk about the process a lot, you know, and let's talk about what we have in common and what you're afraid of. So, first of all, those people over there want to change things. Well, you know, people on the right are notoriously frightened of change, afraid of change. So they say they want to change things, and of course, they want to change them too fast, which always means, when someone says you're changing things too fast, what they always really mean is, I don't want to change anything at all, and that's a good way to say it. It's too fast. They say things like, you know, those people, they frighten them with, you know, xenophobia and racism and sexism and homophobia and all. They use all of these things to try to build a camaraderie with these people and put their arms around them and say, we're all on one side and they're all on the other side. And ultimately, they convince them that all of these other peripheral issues are so important that you can't trust them, you can trust us. So when we tell you that what we're doing is in your best interest, well, we're on your side. Of course you can trust us. You can't trust them because of all these other peripheral issues prove you can't trust them. So even though we're telling you what we're doing is going to work for you, and it's not working for you, just keep believing us anyway, because we're on your side. You can't believe them. And unfortunately, it works. And then the American people overall start looking at the results of what's happening, and they look at the process. The process is confusing. They don't understand the process, and they start looking for people to blame. Instead of trying to understand the process, thus we get where we are now, where everything goes to the wealthy, where... And this is what I think is important. It's not going to change because this is what the system we have now produces.
But see, here's what I think is different. You know, you look at the great Clinton years, heck, even at the Reagan years, and you found a strong economy, and you found virtually all Americans participating. I mean, you can go back to the 50s. I mean, 60s, well, maybe not so much the 70s, but 50s, 60s, 80s, and 90s, you found decades where, yeah, the rich got richer and did very well, but the middle class got richer and stronger, too. This is the first decade where we're really seeing this weird disconnect between fabulous wealth being created, incredible, you know, trillions of dollars for corporations, and the middle class is limping along or actually getting weaker, while, of course, the poor suffer even more. And I think people aren't used to that whole system. They don't realize the system has changed. And so they say, I don't want redistribution of wealth, because they remember back in, you know, not the recent past. I mean, the 90s, when people were willing, happy to do it on their own, and without much regulation, we were able to spread the wealth around, so to speak. Now we have a case where, because of globalization, because of cheap labor in foreign countries, because of technology and so forth, the middle class, I mean, as you point out, 93% of the wealth is going to the 1%. And what I find really ironic is that most of the 1% believe that they're getting too much. A recent poll of millionaires said that 55% of millionaires believe they should be taxed more. So when Republicans say, oh, you know, liberals hate the rich, I don't hate the rich. Most of the rich realize they're getting too much. Warren Buffett and Bill Gates are not the exception. They're the rule. So we're actually appealing, Mitt Romney is appealing, or the Republicans are appealing, not even just to the 1%, but to less than half of the 1%, what we might call the greedy rich, as distinct from the majority of the rich, who are not greedy and recognize we have a very uneven economy.
Yeah, the other thing is this. I mean, think about what happened the first 8 years of the decade. And that, there's a couple things. We started off with what? Was it a $4 or $5 trillion surplus? $5 trillion surplus we started off with.
Hey, wait, it wasn't that high. it was a few $100 billion surplus.
I mean, the projected over the next 10 years.
Oh, you know, if we had not had the Bush tax cuts, it would have become over 10 years of $4 trillion. Yeah, that's true.
Right. Now, we went from that, from a projected $4 trillion surplus to a projected $5 trillion deficit.
Right.
8 years. We had a $9 $1 trillion, $1.1 trillion per year. If you really look at the numbers, if you projected a turnaround,
right,
which all went to the wealthy because it was through tax cuts, and it was through wars and all these, and it was through the Medicare Part D. All those went to the super mega rich corporations or the super mega rich defense contractors.
Right, pharmaceutical companies did very well. Healthcare insurance companies did very well, and of course, defense contractors. You're absolutely right.
So we had over 8 years, $1.1 trillion per year, as far as the projected debt. You know, I don't want to play with numbers, but the projected debt over the course of a decade. A turnaround of $1.1 trillion a year. It should be no shock to anyone that taking $1 trillion a year out of the pockets of the middle class and the poor and putting it into the pockets of the top 1% and the super mega corporations and the super mega defense contractors is going to structurally change the entire economy. So what happened over 8 years is we structurally changed the economy. We took all the money from the poor. We took all the money from the middle class. We handed it all, and we created a system through, and here's the other part, over the course of those years, and this was really, really important, I think, the Bush administration over 8 years, and people say blame the Bush administration. I'm going to blame those 8 years. The Bush administration decided that all of the positions in government of any significance that made any important decisions were going to be manned or woman, whatever the case may be. But in the Bush administration, it was predominantly manned by people who were had the dirtiest hands in that particular industry. So the Department of Interior, you want to take people who run the coal industry and, you know, strip miners and old growth forest cutters and put them in charge. They put the foxes in charge of the hen houses, which if handing the money in wasn't enough in Medicare Part D and in unfunded wars and tax cuts, they changed the rules of the game so that these super mega corporations could do everything they want, destroy our economy, et cetera. So we structurally changed our economic system to a point where what we have now, Americans can be angry all they want to. But if you have a machine, you know, if you have a soup company and you have a machine and that company and that machine is designed to produce 12-ounce soup cans, the only thing you're going to get is 12-ounce soup cans. If you have an economy that is structured to give all the money to the top 1%, it's not, that's what it's going to do.
Yeah, but here's the problem, Garland. People don't see it at their individual level, right? I mean, when Ross Perot talked about that giant sucking sound 20 years ago now, of jobs heading outside the United States, people don't see it in their ordinary lives. And they say, well, the government is taking it from us in taxes, even though taxes are actually lower, substantially lower than they were just 10 years ago. But what they are is much, much lower on the big corporations and on very wealthy people. And so then the government says, well, we have to cut our services because we cut taxes on these very rich people. And for the ordinary person struggling to get along, they're just saying, well, I don't understand why my wages aren't going up. I don't understand why I've got to work twice as hard to keep the same job. I don't understand why there's a layoff in my factory. And they don't see it as these very large and personal forces. You know, they don't allow cameras at Foxconn in the Chinese factory that makes some half of all the technology in the United States, which is amazing. I mean, there's this town in China where there's, I forget how many millions of people who are working at slave labor wages, you know, children and everything, to make our technology. And one of the reasons is because we have a tax policy that actually rewards corporations for taking jobs overseas rather than for keeping them at home. And all of this is out of the way, and it's out of the news, and it's out of our sight. And all we can see is, you know, we have unemployment. It went down 0.2%. You know, way to go, Obama. It went down to 7.7%. But what we're not doing is having policies that actually allow the middle class to get a fair shot. I mean, when I look at the ways that we achieve in America, the main way is education. And with the sequester and everything, what's getting cut? Student loans. Equal opportunity, chances for people to succeed. So I guess my question for you, Garland, is what specific things do we have to do to allow more income equality? I guess we got to tax the wealthy more, right? And allow programs for people to keep their homes and students to get their loans, things like that.
You know what? I don't want to get philosophical. Well, okay, I'll get philosophical.
Go for it.
The problem is not what we need to do and what we're doing. The problem is why we're doing it. You know, you can't convince a person to stop, you know, an alcoholic to stop drinking, or, you know, a person with a substance abuse problem to stop using the substance, until they, at a very basic fundamental level, start to understand that this is hurting me, this is not good, and I need to change. So we are struggling in this country with people who are supporting arguments that are counterproductive to their own economic needs. As long as we have that issue, we can't do it. And furthermore, we now have a dysfunctional government where gerrymandering has, in a very, very, we've created this weird kind of loop where, through gerrymandering, the Republican Party has taken control of the House for all eternity, you know, at least till 2020. But also through gerrymandering and giving themselves control of the House and ensuring that the rural areas have more economic power, they've also ensured that the most angry, ignorant, social conservative, authoritarian wing of their party basically yanked the entire government around.
For those of you who don't know what gerrymandering is, it is, of course, the drawing of district lines, the lines on the map, to favor your candidate or your party. And it's quite powerful. If you haven't studied it, you may not realize how powerful it is. You can take a state that is 60% Democrat and ensure that it has a 75% Republican representative just by drawing the district lines. It's a little complicated, but play with math. It's actually fun to do it on your own. You know, draw your random place. All you do is you basically take. Let's look at a state like Virginia. I mean, Virginia is a purple state. It is a state that voted for President Obama in the last two elections. It's a state that has two Democratic senators. It has a Republican governor. It's a state that can go either way, 50-50, maybe even slightly leaning blue, because after all, except for the governor, we've got in Virginia, as I said, two elections for President Obama and two Democratic senators. All right, so we're blue or purple, but Virginia, out of its 11 members of Congress, 8 of them are Republican. Only 3 are Democrats. And you say, well, how can that happen? It should be 6-5 one way or the other. And the answer is that the Democrats are all in the way you draw the district lines. They're all getting 90%, 80%, really high levels of the vote. And Republicans are getting 55%. And if you do the math, do it at home, practice with your own maps, you can see that you can actually take a state that's even majority Democratic, and by putting all the Democrats in the same district and spreading the other ones out in the other districts, you can create a Republican majority. And we should always remember, the majority of Americans voted for Democrats in the House. The minority of Americans voted for Republicans in the House. The Democrats won the House on the basis of the vote, which in a democracy you think would count. But on the basis of district lines, that's the reason why Speaker Boehner has power. That's the reason why we're not getting anything done. It's not because of the voters. The voters voted for Democrats. It's because of the way the lines were drawn. It's because of the way the game was rigged. And that's a really important point I want Obama to talk about it a little bit more. I want Obama to remind the country, the majority of Americans voted for a Democratic president, the majority of Americans voted for a Democratic Senate, the majority of Americans voted for a Democratic House. So, a basis of majority and democracy and legitimacy, the Democrats control our branches of government. On the basis of, how you fix the lines and rig the game and draw them, we understand why the Republicans are in control, but he needs to make very, very clear, this Republican House has no legitimacy. Sometimes you can win the game on a technicality. And we all know the difference between, the refs and when we had those substitute refs. I forget which team won, but we all know the other team really won. It's just because the refs made a bad call. That's what's going on here. And that's something that I'd like to see the president actually say very clearly. Remember, the Americans rejected you, Republicans, in the House. And even though you have the power under the Constitution, and I respect that legal right you have, let's not forget the fact that the Americans voted you out of office, and you should remember that, because eventually it'll be 55-60%, and we'll get the percentages we need to kick you out.
Well, the other part of it is this, too. It has created another very strange and problematic dynamic for both the country and the Republican Party, and that is since you have these very red districts, which are very, very rural and red districts, it didn't just put the Republicans in power. It gave a lot of power to a particular element within the Republican Party, the element that is the most problematic for America as a whole, and even for the Republican Party. So what they've done is they've created a political environment wherein those who are, and I'll use this word, the most politically ignorant, the most intransigent, the most authoritarian, are the ones who hold the power over the party. And so they're putting in people who the Republicans are, as a party, are unhappy with, who even their own party, the more intellectual, wing of their party, the more moderate wing of their party, if there even is such a thing, knows they can't deal with that. You know, they're even a problem for them. So they've created their own monster, both for themselves and for America. And ultimately, you know, I believe in the Frankenstein theory. When you create a monster, it'll come back to kill you. This authoritarian wing of the party is destroying the party from the inside out. And while in the short term they have the House, they are the record they're creating, the way that they're conducting themselves, the craziness that they're showing. They're sending a message to the American people that you don't want these people in charge ever. And they're going to be 25 years dealing with that. In fact, they may destroy the part of the party ultimately. By the time that 2020 comes and there's redistricting again, the Republican Party is going to be in such tatters that they're going to be done for. I think they'll go the way of the wig.
Well, I tell you, I hope we don't have to wait that long. The Washington Post had an article talking about President Obama trying to get a Democratic House in 2014, recognizing that, you know, 52% of the vote won't cut it. We may need 56% of the vote, a lot more than the majority we need to win a majority in the House. That's because of the districting lines. And of course, when that article came out, Republicans immediately accused Obama of playing politics. Well, you know, when the Republicans are stymieing everything, why shouldn't he play politics? Isn't by winning a majority of the American people, isn't that how we get things done here? So just on the issue of income inequality, there's going to be tax reform. It's going to come up in the next probably few months. And Republicans are going to be trying to lower taxes even further for the super rich.
Always.
And I think President Obama needs to remind the American people of the facts we talked about, of, as you say, Garland, 1% getting 93% of the nation's wealth, and recognizing that, hey, you know, the 99%, they need our help. The 1% don't. And go ahead and trot out the Warren Buffetts and the Bill Gates of the world saying, you know, we don't need any more money. We have enough. We think the rest of America needs some, too. And that's not playing politics. That's just telling the truth. And Americans need to know that truth.
And here's the other part. They accuse him of playing politics. He's a politician.
Right.
You know, okay, so is that like saying you're going to accuse a plumber of plumbing?
I guess so.
If they say you're playing politics, my answer would be, I'm a politician.
And
what am I supposed to do?
I'll tell you someone else who may have been playing politics, and I really want to go into this in detail, because this is an issue that actually splits the left and the right. And has to do with the drone strikes. Rand Paul, of course, had a very famous filibuster, a real filibuster, a speaking filibuster, one that lasted 12 hours. We haven't seen that in a very long time. We can talk about that, too. I know that's your issue, Garland. I want to talk about drone strikes both abroad and at home. And then coming up in just half an hour after the Raucous Caucus, we got a really special inside scoop planned all about drug policy, specifically on whether or not we should legalize marijuana. It's happening in state after state. I've got an incredible number of guests on all sides of the issue, not just those who are against current drug policy, but even a guy from the White House who supports the drug policy, and we're going to go through some really incredible guests. So don't miss that. That's coming in just half an hour on the Inside Scoop. So we got a half hour of drone strikes and then 2 hours of drugs. What could be more fun on a Sunday? So if you want to call in and join this discussion, it's 202-889-9797, 202-889-9797, or you can call toll-free 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back right after this. Welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine. I am here with
Garland Nixon.
And we are talking about, well, everything under the sun. You're welcome to call in 202-889-9797 or 888-488-MARK. If you're listening on the stream, 888-488-6275. We were talking about the income inequality and the fact that our House isn't very democratic. I want to move on now to Garland's topic. Garland, you wanted to talk about, I guess, drones in America. Tell us about that.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
I want to talk about a couple of things. I want to talk about what Eric Holder, I talked about on my radio show the other night, and I'll relate a little bit of that to you, and we'll talk about it. So what happened? Rand Paul basically asked the Justice Department, he asked Eric Holder whether the Justice Department, whether he believed that President Obama had the legal authority to order a targeted strike against an American citizen located within the United States. Now, you notice he said a targeted strike. He did not limit it to drones. People say drones. He didn't limit it to drones.
Right.
Could have been a targeted strike in America.
Meaning a plane could drop a bomb on, the people in Waco who are holed up with
guns. Theoretically, it could be a tank round.
But right,
strike
right, yeah.
Strike is a strike. You know what I mean? I mean, if it could be whatever. Basically, when he says a targeted strike, when you send in SEAL Team 6 to kill somebody.
Isn't that what we did to Chris Dorner, the renegade Los Angeles Police Department officer?
Right. So
held up in a cabin.
What does, and people went berserk over what Eric Holder said, and on both the left and the right, and I disagreed with a lot of people, and we're going to talk about why. So, what did Holder say? He said, now, number one, he rejected the use of military force where well-established law enforcement authorities in this country provide the best means for incapacitating a terrorist attack. So he said, if the cops can do it, then we don't need to do it. The federal government, the military doesn't need to. First and foremost, this is the cops' job, right? He said, but in theory, it would be legal for the president to order such an attack under certain circumstances. So, as a result, what happens? There is an incorrect interpretation of that. Number one, a lot of people on the left and right said, he's saying that the government can order drone strikes in America. That's not what he said. He said that, and I quote, it is possible, I suppose, to imagine an extraordinary circumstance in which it would, listen to this, extraordinary circumstance. Let's start with that. In which it would be necessary and appropriate under the Constitution and applicable laws of the United States for the president to authorize the military to use lethal force within the territory of the United States. Now, anyone who thinks that the president can't or hasn't been able to, or that any president couldn't authorize the use of lethal military force in the United States, here's what I advise you to do. Drive over to the nearest military base, and when you get to the entrance, when the MPs say to you, stop and show me ID, say, I'm not showing you ID, and keep on driving. And you will
see military force.
The military already has the authority to use military force because they're going to fill you full of holes.
And you know what? I would. You gave a present day example. I would give an example from 230 years ago when our first president, George Washington, faced a number of farmers in western Massachusetts who did not want to pay their whiskey taxes. It's called the Whiskey Rebellion.
Right.
And what
right,
did yes. he do? He sent in the military to put down these farmers. He did a targeted strike against American citizens, and he used the military to do it, to put down this rebellion of Americans that didn't want to pay their whiskey taxes. So it can happen today, and it can also happen in the 1790s.
Now, I'm going to add this. Not only should the president, because remember, he said, he quantified, he said, number one, under extraordinary circumstances, he said, I can imagine circumstances, extraordinary circumstances. He even said, it should be the cop's job first. Law enforcement should do it first. Now, let me throw this out. And I would, and you know, it's funny because
I'm just going to give one more example, and that is of Abraham Lincoln. There was a certain difference of opinion between 1861 and 1865 where a whole bunch of Americans decided to rebel against the national government.
Yeah,
some of you may have heard of it. It's called the Civil War. More Americans died in it, frankly, than all our other wars put together. And what did Abraham Lincoln do? He used the military to target American citizens within the borders of the United States, and Lincoln is not seen as some renegade you know, maybe John Wilkes Booth thought he was a tyrant, but the vast majority of Americans still revere him as a pretty good president today. So just wanted to throw those two examples out.
This, Let me give you another example. And I say, not only does the president have the authority, not only have all presidents had the authority, they better have the authority. In fact, they will be negligent if they don't. So let me throw this out there. Let's just say you're driving down the road in a truck bomb and you're heading towards Calvert Cliff Nuclear Power Plant. And we get the information, and the government knows it. And the cops say, we can't get anywhere near that truck. That truck bomb will blow away. If they torch that truck bomb, it'll take out anything within 10 city blocks. So we can't get anywhere near it with a helicopter or anything. We can't do it. Even if we come near it with a helicopter, we don't have any method of taking this truck out. And they call Patuxent River Air Force Base, and they say, we got some drones that can take the truck out. Before it gets to Calvert Cliff Nuclear Power Plant and blows up one of the reactors and, you know, nukes and, you know, Three Mile Island on steroids. Now, and I would say to people, would you say that the president should authorize a drone strike on that truck bomb to stop it from blowing up the nuclear power plant? Or should he say, well, we haven't read the guy's rights? The president, let him go. We'd be better off to allow this guy to take out a nuclear reactor and cause a nuclear meltdown than we would to use a drone. Here's what I say. Drones, moon, B-52, F-16, F-4, I don't care what you use. The president has a responsibility, has a duty based on his oath of office to protect the citizens of the United States. He better take that truck out with anything he has.
Okay, now, but Garland, let's discuss the counterargument, because there are people on the left and the right. Interestingly, they tend to be on the farther edges of both the left and the right, who say, no, but wait a minute. This power can be abused. Richard Nixon, you know, famously, broke into headquarters, looked through people's taxes. If we have a president now who can assassinate people at will, why can't that president take out his political opponents? Why can't the president say, we kill first and then later we call you a terrorist? I mean, we should have normally court processes. We should have warrants and things like that. What's to prevent, maybe not President Obama, but a renegade president from abusing this power? And that is a fair question.
It is a fair question, but it has nothing to do with what Eric Holder said. It's a different subject. It's saying, should the president have this power? Now, first of all, the first thing we have to acknowledge is this. Every president who has ever been president of the United States has had that power, and everyone who ever is president in the future or becomes president will have that power. So the idea that they will abuse the power, it's always going to be there, and there is no way that we should say to any president that if a truck bomb or if some American citizen is flying a plane full of dynamite into Calvert Cliff Nuclear Power Plant, that the president should not be able to stop him with any force necessary.
Okay, I'll be very clear here, but you're talking about an imminent threat. Now, I would be very, very clear. We're not talking about the leader of the mafia is sitting at a cafe and we can get him. In fact, Eric Holder was specifically asked that question. You've got, Osama bin Laden, and he's walked into the local McDonald's, because we know Osama bin Laden loves those Big Macs. He's dead now. But, he specifically asked, could they take out somebody in a cafe? And he said no. They asked him if it was not an imminent threat, could he take them out? And he said no. It's very, very important that we make clear it's an imminent threat, because otherwise, what do? You go by the Constitution and you get a warrant out for somebody's arrest, and the police come in and they arrest the guy. We're talking only about an imminent threat. That's a real important point.
And that's my problem with what the discussion, both Rand Paul and a lot of people on the left and right. He particularly said we can't do that, but people on the left and right are arguing as though he didn't say that. He specifically said, because you have Rand Paul, well, I don't want to be in a Starbucks in San Francisco, not that he'd ever be in a Starbucks in San Francisco, but I don't want to be in a Starbucks in San Francisco and have a drone strike kill me, when in fact Eric Holder specifically said we can't do that.
Right, right. So now the only issue that's left, though, is there are those that are arguing the government hasn't defined imminent threat in such a way, although I think the words imminent threat are pretty clear, imminent threat, but they say that that in the memo they've defined imminent threat to be not so imminent, and so we can argue around the edges about that.
Right, but the fact of the matter is imminent threat is subjective anyway. So can you define, if you specifically, legally define imminent threat, and something comes up that is clearly an imminent threat, but you know, now you know how the law is, you look at it and say, holy moly, we never stopped to think that could happen. So we didn't put it in the law as an imminent threat. Yeah. What happens? Now, faced with something that clearly is an imminent threat, but it is not something that you specifically articulated and defined in the law. So now, if you act, you're acting outside of the law. If you don't act, they blow a nuclear power plant sky high.
The other thing is, if it happens in the United States of America, with our free press and our TV cameras and our iPhones that record everything, it's not like it's going to be done secretly, right? I mean, if the President of the United States orders a strike in Oregon or where else, I just said Oregon because that's where Terry is. Run, Terry, run!
But
if they order a strike, we're going to know about it. And the ultimate way to police a renegade president is the same way we've always had in the Constitution, impeachment. If the president's going out assassinating his or her political enemies, and they start dying in cafes one after the other, I think we'll know about it, and I think we'll have the power to impeach such a renegade president. So there really still are checks and balances in the United States. And just the criticism in the press. Now, remember, President Obama has never done this in the United States of America. He simply reserved his right to do it. You know, Abraham Lincoln was certainly criticized.
Mark, when you say he reserves his right to do it, it's important to define what it is.
All right.
Because people are running forward saying that it means blowing up anybody anytime they want to, using a drone strike on the corner of, you know, 14th and U, to take out everybody at Ben's Chili Bowl. When the fact of the matter is, they specifically said they can't do that. See, this is the problem I have. They specifically said that they can't do that. And the discussion is as though they specifically said they can do that, number one. Number two, the only discussion is about drone strikes, as though drones, we need to talk about that also, as though drones were evil or they, you know, we're assigning some sort of emotional intellect towards, you know, to drones when it's nothing but a word, you know. But we'll get to that in a second anyway. So I say, if you're going to have a discussion, have an honest discussion about what was said. And if the man said, under extraordinary circumstances, I can see an instance where it would be appropriate and necessary. And I ask people, do you disagree with that? And they would say, yes. I'd say, what part of that statement do you disagree with? And they'd say, well, the government will use power to do that. I said, whoa, whoa, whoa. What part of that statement do you disagree with? I have yet to have anyone on the left say to me, I disagree with the part that says the government should be able to stop a truck bomb or a 747 from flying into Calvert Cliffs nuclear power plant. I think the government shouldn't be able to do that because there's an American citizen in the cockpit.
It's not just an American citizen, by the way. It's also American soil. There was a lot of discussion. We did kill, and let's be very clear, the President of the United States did order a drone strike on an American citizen. Anwar Alaki is his name. He was in Yemen. He's an American citizen. I forget, I think by birth, I think he was born here. He's also the leader of an Al-Qaeda cell in Yemen. And we do not have an extradition treaty with Yemen. There was no way that law enforcement could, by ordinary power, bring him to justice. Obviously, if it had been, he'd been in France or England or Canada or some country with which we have relations, we would rely on the French or Canadian or English authorities to pick him up and extradite him to the United States. And they took him out with a drone strike. So that is an American citizen. And you could argue it wasn't an imminent threat because, while the guy's a terrorist and was certainly plotting to get us, I don't know that we knew a specific plan. Right. But within the American borders is a very, very different circumstance, and that's something that Obama has never done and certainly has no plans to do.
And that's my point, too. And I would say to people, when it comes to our drone policies overseas, I agree with you on most of the issues and most of the problems on the overseas drone strikes. Absolutely. You know, I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm against, you know, blowing up a building where there either is or may be innocent people in it. You know, and I think that we cause ourselves more problems than we solve with those drones by, you know, all of the innocent people that we kill. as they call collateral damage, but they're really innocent people. So I'm 100% with that on foreign soil and on even on American soil. But I want an honest discussion. And if you're going to say to me, I got a problem with what Eric Holder said and with the president being able to kill Americans, to order the military to kill Americans on American soil, then we have to have an honest discussion. And we have to acknowledge that every president has ever had it. And if you don't think so, if you don't think that the president can authorize lethal force, then all you need to do is drive to your near military base and try to drive on there without showing them ID. If you don't think they can do that, then all you have to do is try to blow through the gate at the local military, at the local nuclear power plant in your truck, and watch what happens when you get shot. So in a true, honest discussion, we don't get away from, but the government will abuse their power. That's a different discussion, and I agree with that. But it's not the same as saying the government should never be able, or that Eric Holder's wrong for saying that there are, in fact, circumstances where the president better authorize the use
right.
of force.
There's an important distinction.
Separate
right.
discussion.
An important
That's
distinction between saying whether the president should have the power and whether the president should or is abusing
how
the power.
Here's
what I find most interesting. The left, at least, is consistent on this point. They were angry at Bush for doing these kinds of things. They're angry at Obama for doing these kinds of things. At least they're consistent on this point, and we can argue about the extent to which Bush or Obama are abusing the power with strikes overseas. The right, however, is laughably inconsistent. Rand Paul had his filibuster, and I believe that Rand Paul legitimately believes what he believes. You could say he's grandstanding, and he is, but he legitimately, I think, opposes any president who does almost anything with the military.
I was about to say, he's opposed to any form of organized government.
Right, pretty much. Right, right. So he's pretty consistent. But Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Republicans, the guy who never found anything Bush did that he ever opposed, who supported the Iraq War, who supported all the no-bid contracts to Halliburton, who supported Abu Ghraib. I mean, this is a guy who never said peep to anything in Bush's military policy. To see him support Rand Paul filibuster against Obama doing much, much less than Bush did, I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. I got to give credit to the left. They've consistently opposed it all. The right, is just Mitch McConnell, give me a break.
Well, Mitch McConnell and the right, they are very consistent. Anything that a Republican president does
is okay. Right.
And anything that the Democrat does is wrong. So there is consistency. Yeah. It's a very hypocritical consistency.
Right, right.
That demonstrates who they really are. But they're, how about we say this? They're consistently hypocritical.
There you go. Let me say this, though. I am glad we've had this debate. I am glad that actually some Democratic senators were insistent on, for example, the memo. We had Ron Wyden of Oregon, kind of a maverick, if you will, Democrat, but he insisted on getting a memo from the Justice Department about the drone strikes prior to approving John Brennan. And there are certainly those, and I'm glad we spelled it out. I'm glad Eric Holder was asked the question. I'm glad he spelled it out.
You're falling into the trap. You said drone strikes.
Well, it wasn't.
It was about the president having the authority to authorize lethal force on the
United States.
Drones.
Okay, it wasn't limited to drones. I guess drones has a scary idea.
That's something else I got to say, and that is this. You know, they had over at UDC the other day. They had a protest about drones. I think that is mistaken. You see, I don't have a problem with drones. No problem with drones. A drone is just an unmanned aerial vehicle. Drones, big deal, they mean nothing. People are using this word drones, and it's like there's brain association.
Killer bees. Killer bees are called drones.
Drone means this. Now, here's the problem. You say to the government, I want these drones stopped. We got to stop these drones. No more drone strikes. And the president says, you don't want any more drone strikes? Yeah. Okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to ground all drones. And they say, hooray, we won. And the next day, what happened? There was a Tomahawk missile fired into an Afghani school that killed 5,000 children. And the government says to you, you told us to stop using drones. We told you we were going to use Tomahawk missiles, F-14, bunker buster missiles. We're going to use, artillery rounds.
But Garland, let me say this.
Hellfire missiles. We'll just fire them from helicopters.
Garland, If Terry were here, and Terry is sick today, so I got to give him a little bit of a voice. If Terry were here, he would say that he's opposed to drones for this reason. He thinks that when you go in from your with your little joystick in Atlanta and remotely control an airplane, you know, on the other side of the globe, shooting down people in Afghanistan, that you are less likely to be as careful as a bomber in the air who's risking his or her own life to take out someone. I don't know that that's true. I mean, maybe you would think that a person flying a plane over Afghanistan is scared because they could get shot down and be more likely to take aggressive action even if civilians are involved. And maybe some guy sitting very safely in Atlanta or NORAD or North Dakota, wherever they are, might actually have the calmness to say, you know what, I'm not going to shoot this this terrorist who is walking by the school because they're not in fear for their life. But I do know Terry's argument, and I've heard it, and he basically says that there's something unfair to some extent about fighting a battle where you don't risk loss to your own life, and of course you cause tremendous damage to the other side. I just want you to address that.
I would make the point that then you don't understand military policy. Here's the problem. I don't have a problem with drones. A drone is a tool that is used to execute a policy. I have a problem with the policy. If you see, Terry obviously wouldn't understand this. When the order comes down, these are the coordinates for the strike. The person running this drone from Colorado does not have the ability to say, General so-and-so, I'm not going to launch on the coordinates for this strike.
Right, right. It's the president's decision.
These are the coordinates,
ultimately.
And go shoot it.
Right.
And if they use a Tomahawk missile 1,100 miles away or whatever, they have the coordinates for a strike. They determine they're going to make the strike. And it doesn't matter what the person running, whichever vehicle it is, whichever aerial vehicle it is. So he would be mistaken because he would think that the individual pilot, if you want to call him that, of the drone has the lead way to say to his superiors, no, I will not like launch the strike on the target that I've been ordered to launch. So I say,
well, they might.
We have to target the policy and say, I don't like the policy that does this, because you're targeting the tool for the policy. And as I've seen, I used to work in government, and when someone would say, we don't like the fact that you're using this tool, they would say, we'll give you what you want, we're not going to use that tool again. And then they just use a different tool.
Yeah, no, I agree. You have to go after the policy, not the tool. I don't know. It's actually a fair question. We need to have, maybe I'll bring someone in on the inside scoop. We'll bring a military person in to ask the question. I do know that in the Israeli army, if they are ordered to do an attack and they see civilians, you know, maybe they're attacking one of those rockets that flies across the border from Gaza and lands in villages in Israel. If they see civilians near the rocket launching, the individual attacking, the Air Force pilot, has the individual authority to not strike. In most circumstances, if they see civilians there, I hope that's our policy too. I hope that if we're out, if you're given the coordinates for a target, that the person that is manning the joystick or whomever would be able to say, you know what, I'm going to hit that target, but I'm going to wait 20 minutes because I see some people passing by. I hope they would have that.
And here's the thing about it: these drones have very, very powerful cameras that can zoom in from miles away.
So they, I mean, hopefully they can circle around in the air a little bit and wait. Yeah. Until the appropriate time, and even if the airstrike is ordered at 4 a.m., and they see some people walking past, they can wait till 4:10 a.m. or something like that.
So my point in all of this is, my issue is not with the drones. My issue is with the policy and those who are protesting drones or just using the word drones or running around in fear of drones don't recognize that the drones are nothing more than a tool.
Right.
And that if we ground all drones, they will simply use another tool to execute the policy. If you don't like the policy, argue against the policy. If you don't like the tool, then apparently you don't have any problem with the policy because
right.
You can use another tool.
It's a fair point. Argue where the people controlling the weapons. It's not the weapons. It's although I can make an argument about guns, but we won't go there. That's all
different.
The time.
It's
individuals.
That would be different.
It's individuals,
well,
not a government.
There's a difference between a drone that has a nuclear missile on it and
right.
A drone that has a Hellfire missile.
There's also a difference between a drone controlled by the President of the United States, elected by the American people, and a drone drone controlled by Joe Crazy out there. Right. So that's the difference.
So there are always degrees, whether you're using drones, what they have. You know, the same with guns. Is it a 22 caliber single shot, or do you have a 100 shot round? You know what I mean?
Our time is up, though. I got to end this segment.
Holy moly.
The Raucous Caucus, it's 1 o'clock. Raucous Caucus is over. Thank you so much for your time, Garland. I appreciate it.
All right.
Very good discussion. Coming up next, the inside scoop on drug policy. You don't want to miss that. Coming up right after this.